Hey everybody, today I'm going to talk about The Wickwire Watch by Jacqueline Hagan. It is the first book in the Riverfall Chronicles, came out in September of 2022, and clocks in at 442 pages long. It is one of the Spiffbo 9 finalists, and so this will be the second book of the Spiffbo finalists to go along with The Fall Is All There Is. Once again, I plan on doing all 10 of them. Just a reminder that normally all of the books I do are at least a semi-recommendation, and these Spiffbo finalists are potentially the only books that won't be that way. In this case, The Wickwire Watch is a book I enjoyed quite a bit, and I would recommend this book to a lot of people. Go into details on that as we do the review. First off, I'm going to do the book blurb, and then we'll get into the review itself. It's the first and greatest rule Inkwell Featherfield ever learned. It's also the only way he knows how to survive, besides picking pockets, dodging the law, and using every ounce of his plucky charm. But none of this will be enough to save him now. If only he'd never snooped around a dead man's house. If only he'd never found that pocket watch full of strange magic. If only he'd known the old man had snuffed it at the hands of the ghostly specters, or that such dark spirits even existed, because now they're after him. When Ink is approached by an enigmatic group offering to keep him safe, he accepts, only to discover his rescuers are a band of infamous fugitives. Who knew they had a flair for winemaking? Or a penchant for sing-alongs? Thrust into a world of arcane horrors, powerful politicians, and dangers on every side, the boy has no choice but to finally break his rule and decide who to trust. But with all the secrets, magic, and mystery thickening around him, and the stakes so much higher than he ever imagined, it might just be downright impossible. I feel like in the last 4 or 5 years, we've gotten blurbs that tell so much more about the story than book blurbs used to. I feel like the old traditional blurbs just gave the most generic of information out, and blurbs now give stuff that I've almost at times would be like, I wonder if I should include this in a spoiler-free review. But if it's in the book blurb, then clearly I'm going to talk about it in the review. I'm going to do this one just a little bit different than I've been doing the last few since I decided to change up my format a little bit. I've been starting off with the world, then the characters, then the plot. But I think that if I start off with the plot and the world kind of intertwined on this one, then it'll be a little bit easier to talk about the characters and then get into the bad, the good, and my own ratings on the book. So the world is a secondary world, but it's really easy to understand. This is absolutely not a Gods of the Weirdwood situation. We have a secondary world on a single continent that has a really easy to understand map. I'm going to give some absolute bonus points to Hagen on including a map that basically has the North Country, the West Country, the East Country, and the South. Makes it so much easier as they're moving around, because they do move around a bit in this book, to understand where things are, especially when I'm reading a digital copy, which is actually my preferred format. I do most of my reading, as I have talked about before, in my tractor, and it's just kind of a pain to bring a book into a tractor, especially when you're making compost, and when it's fresh, it smells like cow manure. So you don't want your books to come back into the house smelling bad at that point. But in this case, the world's really easy to understand. Also, as we get into talking about the world building, it'll let me talk about the races and things like that too. So we have a secondary world. I would say late Victorian technology. There are guns, there are airships. So I guess it's kind of like a gas lamp if we're getting into that. But I felt like it was largely an agrarian civilization that we're talking about. I'm sure that there's more industry somewhere if these guns and things are being made, obviously. But it didn't seem like what we're dealing with is has too many big cities. There are actually two races on this continent. They both appear to be human as far as like their appearance goes. The Entrians are one of them. They're the older race that is on the continent. They can use magic. We're definitely not dealing with like a hard magic system here. Basically, it's more like they use their hands or whatever they want to do. They kind of just think it into existence. the one kind of rule that they discuss a little bit in the story is that you're supposed to keep your emotions in check. That allows you to use your magic more powerfully and better. The more emotion you have involved, then the less potent your magic is. The entry in females are actually supposed to be able to detect when someone's going to lie, but that actually requires them to keep their emotions in check as well. If you're too emotional, then you can't tell when someone is lying, which is kind of an important thing later on in the story. Or I guess important might be going a little too far, but is a detail that matters and later on in the story. The other race is the Kassrians. They cannot use magic. This is a situation where they do generally coexist on the continent. The Entrians did rule over the entire continent for a long period of time, but for various reasons, they have now retreated just to one part of the continent and left the rest of the continent to the Kassrians. The Entrians definitely consider themselves better than the Kassrians, but we weren't dealing with like a situation previously where they were oppressing the Kassrians and the Kassrians had to revolt kind of a situation. They were seen as more like a little bit more of like a benevolent overlord situation. At this point, there are some councils that work together between the two. We also do have some supernatural elements. It appears that there is one single god. We're monotheistic. Both of the Kassrians and the Entrians worship that single god. I didn't feel like we were dealing with a situation where like people are too religious, but there is an actual religious system set up with like churches and things like that. That it's not super important, I don't think, to the average person, but it seems like most people believe. And some of the supernatural beings that we're going to encounter, the one that is mentioned in the book blurb is the Spectres. The Spectres were formerly humans who refused to pass over to whatever the other side is when your soul dies. They are evil, basically. They thrive off of people who have really negative emotions. They can actually possess you, and they can also anchor themselves to certain places and then make anyone who happens to go there feel dark thoughts, and they're an important part to the story. Real quick, I'm going to give the people that are important to the book, and then we'll talk more about those people in the plot. So Inkwell Featherfield is a roughly 13-year-old boy. He seems to be an orphan. The first time we see him, he is actually pickpocketing a constable. So whereas Ink is clearly our protagonist and our main character, the point of view character who gets the second most page time is called Mr. Spindler. He is a newspaper man. He actually witnesses Ink commit this crime with the constable to start off with. And he actually gets involved with Ink, where he wants him to go and discover something for him that we'll talk about when I get into the plot. Mr. Spindler is a newspaper man, as I said. He is a character that at the beginning I thought was going to be kind of a bad guy. Maybe not like a real true bad guy, but I thought that his motives might not be quite so pure. But as the story goes on, he's a character that I liked more and more, and he genuinely feels concerned for what he has gotten Ink into. Caradoc has maybe one or two very minor point of view chapters, but he is the leader of the colonists that we'll talk about here coming up shortly. Then we also have Seherin. I guess that's how you would say your name. She is an Entress. She is leading the Entrian delegation who is attempting to find the colonists who we'll talk more about here shortly. Those are the most important characters. There's a lot of characters that we're going to have that aren't point of view characters, but we're going to learn more about, especially with the colonist group as they're in one area for a long period of time. And we'll get into those as well just a tiny bit. Okay, let's tie that world and those characters in a little bit. Okay, the plot. The book opens with a man named Mr. Bash. He appears to make pens and pencils, and he is going home, and then the next morning he's found dead. That is the extent of the page time for poor Mr. Bash. But it is found that he is a member of a terrorist group called the Colonists. The Colonists may or may not be the absolute boogeyman of the entire world. He supposedly the Colonists killed a whole bunch of those Entrians who were on an island trying to basically make peace with their various clans who were like kind of engaged in a low-level civil war. and they killed like half of all of those people. That includes all of their elders and most of the clan chiefs of the Entrians. It's what also made the Entrians completely just go off on their own at this time. The colonists were all Cassrians, and at this point, like, both Cassrians and Entrians hate them. They've been on the run for 9 years since the incident happened. They're basically accused of any bad thing that possibly happens in the world at this point, all the way up to cannibalism. So once they find out that Mr. Bash was a colonist, then this group that goes in and tries to find the colonists and bring them to justice happens to come into the town that they're in. Mr. Spindler finds Ink and asks Ink to go and search Mr. Bash's house to see if he can find a good story for the newspaper. But Mr. Spindler offers him money. Ink goes to the house and is looking for stuff. When the search party shows up earlier than he expects, it's dark outside. He's trying to hide. But when he sees the entrance, Saharine, he decides she's just so beautiful. He's enchanted by her. And he's trying to listen in on their conversation when he makes some noise accidentally. And he ends up having to run. It's raining. It's dark. And he manages to avoid capture. He finds himself in an abandoned barn where he finds a watch that has the word Wickwire engraved on it. And that next morning, he ends up getting attacked by a specter. He is saved from that specter attack by that Caradoc, who is the leader of the colonists. It's a very quick encounter. Ink runs off. He goes to Mr. Spindler, tells his story. And then Ink gets cut on the cheek mysteriously all of a sudden. And right as that happens, Mr. Spindler's door explodes. And two more of the colonists rush in, tell Ink that they need to save him immediately, and they whisk him off. Mr. Spindler, from this point on, is actually going to become kind of a better character as he feels terrible when he finds out that it's the colonists that took Ink. And in all of his threads will kind of be a little bit world-building threads for us. They've done really well. And there, as he's trying to find ways to figure out how to save Ink from both colonists and figure out what the specters truly are. Ink's story then from here on out, he will actually now be on a floating island that's been enchanted so that it is both silent and can't be seen by people on the ground. And this is where a good deal of the story is going to actually take place. Probably like 50-60% of the book will be world building from this point on. Ink will get to know all of the 12 colonists still living and who are on this island. And he is going to now start to wonder whether the colonists really are good people or bad people. Once he gets to know them, all 12 of the characters will really get some page time through Ink's point of view, obviously. But it's really fun to get to see this world. And it gets a lot of world building that's done while not feeling like an info dump. But it is, as Ink just lives for a couple of months on this island. The beginning of the book and the end of the book are going to be very action-packed, but that middle part is going to be largely world-building. So the beginning of the book and the end of the book will be very action-packed, but that whole middle of the book is going to be that world-building where we learn about the colonists, the world itself, and all the politics of the two sides with the Cassrians and the Entrians. Okay, let's get into the bad and the good. To start off with, I am going to have a real struggle here talking about the bad, and it's going to be a nitpicky thing. For me, I love world building, right? I mean, if I talk about world building in a review, it is always as a positive. I love info dumps. I love slow world building scenes. So for me, what could be considered the bad for some people was a positive for me. But that there's a big portion, probably like, 50-60% of the book pretty easily is spent on that island where we learn about, the world and, the colonists. We learn about Ink, and some people might consider it slow. I would definitely consider this like a cozy read. And so, I think if you're looking for like a super action packed book, then you're going to find, some issue with that, slowness in the middle. So aside from that slowness, though, I really struggled to figure out what could really be considered too bad about the book. Now onto the good, the world building. Obviously, if I'm talking about they're spending a good solid of the part of the book, what feels like world building, but with getting to learn all the characters, That was pretty awesome. I love the floating island that they're on. It's like a little village, and we get to know each of those 12 characters quite a bit through Ink's eyes. You know, all 12 of the colonists are going to get a backstory, and we're going to get to know about them. And I like them all. Not all of them are like great people, but I think that it's great the way that they work together. And I really like to know more about Caradoc, and I hope that we get to learn more about him as the story goes on. He gets more talked about more as the book goes on, and he's clearly a mysterious character where there's a lot more to him than meets the eye, and we learn, you know, most of that towards the end of the book. Ink is a pretty good character for being a teenager. His age is kind of a little bit mysterious. He's somewhere between 12 and 15. He's kind of a small boy, so that's kind of where like the that is. And he really, really wants to keep his age a secret. But I would say that you know, he's not obnoxious. He is a character who you know, has trouble trusting, but there's a good reason for that, and he's really resourceful, and you know, he's a good point of view character. I certainly wouldn't generally think that I would want an adult novel that has a YA main character, but I think it works very well. The other thing that really works for me with this book is, the first 30% took me several days to get to, and not because of the writing at all. I was running solo with my children. My wife was out of town from Sunday through Wednesday night. And so I kind of struggled to really just be in the right headspace to do that, as I had to get the kids ready for school. And then I did a couple days where I wasn't in my tractor. And then in the evening, my son had soccer every night that my wife was gone. So it was a lot of work. And then finally on Friday, I was able to really start reading. I had like 10 hours of composting to do, and I actually read the entire final, maybe like 300 pages in about like 5 hours. And when I got to the end of it, I was really shocked. So clearly this is an easy reading book. I really would describe it as cozy. Once I got into that movie in my mind, there was nothing that took me out of it. You know, no weirdness or anything like that that interrupts the story. It's just a good, solid story that way. So getting into my closing thoughts and my rating, I think I'm going to give this one an 8.5 out of 10. As effusive as I've been in my praise, you might wonder why I'm giving an 8.5 out of 10 instead of a 10 out of 10, when in many ways I've described a book that most of the time I would regard as that 10 out of 10. Well, I think that one of the things is that it did have just so much world building that it felt, you know, sometimes a little too cozy and a little too slow. It's a book that I would have enjoyed reading on a fall or winter day as it's storming outside and I just wanted to sit under a blanket as opposed to, you know, to being like super epic. But one thing I do want to mention is that an awful lot of my books that I have on series that I consider like a full 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 are 4 out of 5s on the first books for me. Some of my absolute favorite ones, I look at like Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn. Almost all of R.J. Barker's series that I consider a 5 out of 5, I've actually rated the first book a 4 out of 5. And Mark Lawrence, same thing. Some of his very first book. I think that some of these books, when they're setting up a ton of the world building, then you have less action to start off with. And I think that I maybe would have liked a little bit more of the action to be interspersed in throughout the whole story, as opposed to, you know, you have action at the beginning. You have a good solid 50 to 60% of the book is slow world building, and then it's just abrupt craziness for the last 15% of the book's nonstop solid. That's a stylistic decision that I think works for an entire series, but maybe takes a point or two off of the first book in the series for me. So I absolutely intend to continue reading the books in this series, and I think that whether this ends up being 3, 4, 5, whatever number of books, it has a great chance of ending up being a 5 out of 5 series for me that I will be recommending to people if you want a cozy read. I guess we'll see how the books, you know, carry on from here. In terms of late Victorian or Gaslamp style, I think that it's absolutely going to end up being a series that I'll end up recommending to people. My next couple of books will not actually be Spiffbo books. They will be books that I have either already read other books in the series and new books are coming out, or they'll be ones that have been on my TBR for a while that I wanted to get to. And then after I do a couple of those, I'll get right back to Spiffbo finalists. There, as I record this, there's five of them out currently. I've now done two of those, and after the next two books, I'll start going right back to them. If you like my videos, please like and subscribe to my channel. You know, as we continue to build this, you need people and views to continue growing, and I appreciate those who have already subscribed, and thank you so much for watching this video.